You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
In this podcast, we are bringing you another highlight from One Crown Office Row's recent seminar, Erasure, Remediation and Rights of Appeal in Disciplinary Proceedings. If you'd like to get a full picture of the seminar, it would be good to go back to the previous two episodes broadcast last week and start from the beginning. In this third episode, we hear from One Crown Office Row's Matthew Barnes with his discussion, Remediation, Can You Teach an Old Dog New Tricks?
What I'd like to do is I'd like to start by adopting the point that it's long been recognised that remediation carries less weight in those cases where there's a need to uphold the proper professional standards and public confidence in the profession. However, I think it's important to recognise that remediation can still play a very important role in those cases. And it seems to me that that is demonstrated by the case of Khan, which is a case in the Pharmaceutical Council and involved a man, Mr. Khan, who had been convicted of a series of offences in respect of his violent behaviour towards his wife, her family and her property. He had assaulted her violently and viciously when he was sharing a house with her, and then when he was removed from the property by the police and ordered not to return, he waited till his wife was out and then took the opportunity to go and visit whilst his wife's sister was looking after the children and threatened to kill her and smashed up the house. He was sentenced to a community payback order which comprised of supervision for 12 months, 180 hours of unpaid work and 6 months attendance at a domestic violence program called Change. The committee that was dealing with him noted that he had diligently complied with his sentence. I'm not entirely clear what diligent compliance was something that you're required to do in order to avoid being sent to prison involves, but he had diligently complied with that, including a course of CBT that was directed towards enabling him to communicate reasonably with his wife. And they accepted that he had genuinely learned the error of his past conduct. This case ultimately came before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, in looking at it, emphasised the relevant parts of the guidance that dealt with mitigating features, and also emphasised the registrar's genuine acknowledgement of fault, the positive reports of his response to his sentence, and concluded that the appropriate sanction was suspension of his registration for 1 year, which struck me as being a pretty good outcome for him, and I think demonstrates that there are potentially two lessons we can take from the case. The first is that we should understand the importance of evidence that can demonstrate change in attitude, and the second is that we should understand the importance of evidence that can demonstrate true understanding of what was done wrong in the past, and that the registrant is suitably apologetic for that. I'm going to deal with those in turn. First of all, in respect of evidence that can demonstrate a change in attitude, it seems to me that the simpler, more straightforward version of this evidence is to get the input from a mentor. But I think that if we're going to engage the assistance of a mentor, we need to have take some care. My experience of mentors is that quite often at the end of the process you find, when you discuss it with them, that half the time has been spent empathising with the registrant in respect of the charges brought against him, and the other half has been spent observing the particular unreasonable behaviour on the part of the regulator. And so you're left with evidence which looks okay on paper but can't possibly be the subject of evidence at the tribunal, because you can't call a witness who is quite likely to say something that is either unhelpful or, in fact, just gets in the way. So I think that there is something to be said about mentors, but I think if you're going to use one, it ought to be someone who is not connected in any too convenient way with the registrant, and someone who you can trust, maybe because you're paying them, to do the job in the way that you'd like them to. The second example I'm going to give is the more expensive Rolls-Royce version of the mentor, and that is to consider instructing a psychologist. Now, it seems to me that that has several advantages. First is that simply engaging the service of a psychologist suggests a high level of insight. The second is that psychologists are trained to bring about change. That's what they're geared up to doing, and they're likely to achieve it in some way. And the third is that because of the way the psychologists approach the problem with detailed analysis and assessment, you are usually going to be able to demonstrate change at the end of the process. However, I ought to strike some warning notes. First of all, you have to have someone who's going to engage with the process. Secondly, it's got to be done early. Otherwise, all you have is a list of faults that need correction rather than correction of those faults. The third thing is that when you look at the report prepared by the psychologist, you need to be aware of the fact that they don't all make really tip-top witnesses, or at least that's my experience in the past. And there is also, I think, a sort of general level of skepticism amongst panels about what they're doing and why they're doing it. But my experience from a dishonesty case was that the role of the psychologist really was twofold. First of all, it did actually, I think, change my client's attitude towards his dishonesty from believing that what had happened was that he told a few white lies to actually understanding that he'd done something that really wasn't acceptable. And the second thing was that I think on balance, the panel found the psychologist more helpful than they were critical of her approach. So I think it's a useful tool. The second point that I was going to deal with is the importance of evidence that can show genuine remorse and steps have been taken to avoid recurrence. I'm going to give you an example of a very recent case, a case called Mehta, M-E-H-T-A, that was recently dealt with by the second division of the inner house of the Court of Session. The case is remarkable for the steps that the doctor took to demonstrate that he had properly understood where he had gone wrong. Dr. Mehta had invited a junior doctor to his room to view a teaching presentation. I think that we can already guess where this story is going. What happened was that he didn't show the junior doctor any presentation slides, but instead explained to her that if she found someone to confide in who was not her boyfriend, that would not be cheating. Hugged her, pressed his chest to hers, and kissed her on the shoulder. These allegations are obviously embarrassing for more than one reason. To his credit, Dr. Mehta responded to the charges arising out of this conduct with not only an early admission, but, and I quote, publicly involving himself in presentations and discussions which were specifically based on his own inappropriate behaviour, and at least one of which was attended by more than 75 colleagues. In doing so, he had, again I quote, demonstrated a degree of insight, remorse and willingness to improve himself and concern for his profession, which was exceptional. The tribunal imposed no sanction at all, and that was upheld by the court on appeal. Now, the difficulty that strikes me in respect of all of that is that I find it quite difficult to persuade my clients to tell even their close colleagues where they've gone wrong in the past for the purpose of getting some assistance from them. The idea of persuading one of my clients to stand up in a room full of 75 of those colleagues and tell a story such as the one that Dr. Mehta did, I think it's unlikely in most cases. But I think what you can do is you can encourage your clients to take a leaf out of Dr. Mehta's books, even if they're not prepared to go the whole way, and emphasize to them the importance in taking steps in their remediation which engage not only with apologies and declarations of change, but instead to actually go out and demonstrate in a practical way that they've engaged with why what they did was wrong, and if possible, to assist others in learning from their mistakes. And you can think of less dramatic examples and less difficult examples. For example, a dentist may feel that it was appropriate to talk to their professional colleagues at the dental surgery about an area which they got wrong in the past and intend to get right in the future. So there are, I think, circumstances in which that approach can be taken without the sort of registrant having the sort of willingness that Dr. Mehta did to bare their soul. In summary, really, it's not, I think, quite as bleak as it appears when you look at some of the cases that are being appealed. There is some scope for taking steps in respect of remediation that address the public confidence and what the public believe, but I share the views of my colleagues that they're difficult cases to get out of.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.